Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 279, and we're going to find a bright spot in every aurora. I know many of you saw the Aurora Borealis last night, and that's not what I'm talking about. We're also going to talk about looking at temperature insulation like electrical insulation. There is an analog there. A tale from the road involving some ice cream in Aurora, Maine, and a place to visit some big old water pumps that have names, and they're hidden, and only the special people know where they are. I'm going to tell you where they are. A lot of people don't know where they are. But anyway, welcome back. Thank you for joining me here for episode 279. I have been busy with what used to be NaNoWriMo and is now NovNov. And if those sounds don't actually translate to words in your head, I understand. This is the novel writing project that's been going on for a couple decades now, where folks are invited to write a novel in the month of November. And the way a novel is described or defined is that it's 50,000 words. That's it. Doesn't have to be the complete work. It absolutely doesn't have to be the finished, polished work. The point is to get 50,000 words down on paper so that you can get in the habit of writing. I have been wanting to do this for quite a while, and this year I'm actually doing it, and I'm writing a book about all my visits to the auroras. And if you haven't heard, I've said this 8 million times, I feel like, but I have visited every place named Aurora in North America. That is 21 places. For several of them, I've been there many times, and I have stories from each of them. Each of them was fascinating. You would think that with that many different places, that the only thing they have in common is the same name. Some of them would have absolutely nothing to talk about, but no, I found something interesting in every single place. And I also found a lot of dark history. And as I'm writing the book and doing research, I'm finding myself just burdened by the darkness of history. There's some bad stuff. And it's really difficult to see the parallels between the bad stuff that happened in, going back as far as 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s in the U.S. And then what's going on today in the U.S. It's like, folks, the writing's on the wall. You can see it here. Anyway, it's a burden. It's hard. I don't like living in this world, but it is the world. This is all what actually happened, and I need to know it and to come to terms with it to complete this book. But it's not always fun. And I thought, because of that, I should do something in a completely opposite direction. In this episode, I'm going to take you to every place named Aurora in North America and tell you one thing to see there, one interesting thing in every place named Aurora. Now, they're not all of equal value, and they are certainly not the only thing to see in these places, but they're all kind of interesting, and that was part of what I wanted to find on this trip is these places have nothing in common except their name. And while it's an intriguing name, it's not the kind of name that you pick for no reason, there's really a lot more going on here. And it's one of the reasons I have taken so long to actually come to terms with this project, is that there's so much, so many stories, so much content, it's difficult to know what threads I want to follow. And just as a side note, I talked a lot about a van life book at the beginning of the year, had surgery, that got sidetracked. My plan is that after I finish the 50,000 words of the Aurora project, I will return back to the van life book, which is actually finished. The first very, very, very rough draft is done. So I'm going to return to that and finish that up and hopefully get that out the door, and then come back and start the actual process of really writing the Aurora's book, which is called editing and rewrites. But at any rate, let us take you on a tour of every place named Aurora in North America. It might seem odd, but this is the order that I visited them in when I did my trip in the spring, summer, and fall of 2019. So number one, Missouri, Aurora, Missouri. Aurora, Missouri, when you drive around the town, you will see a sign on an old caboose that says, "Don't kick our dog." And there's a picture of a hound dog, and the words "don't kick our dog" are in quotes. Like, what? I wasn't going to kick your dog. What does that mean? Well, it turns out that that's from an old song called You Gotta Stop Kicking Our Hound Around or Our Dog Around. There's different versions that the local National Guard unit used, the 203rd National Guard unit, called the Hound Dog Units. And they adopted this song, Don't Kick Our Dog, and it became their slogan. And now it kind of is like the town's slogan. And I believe the high school is the Hound Dogs. And anyway, it's just kind of an odd little thing to do research on. You can listen to the song on YouTube, and there's a whole bunch of different versions. But it's kind of a weird song. It's about, like, this guy who's got a dog, and everybody in town's kicking the dog. And he's like, hey, stop kicking our dog. That's all there is to it. A little bit odd, but kind of interesting. And you can find more about the story in the museum that's right where the caboose is downtown. Number two, Aurora, Texas. One of the more famous auroras. Aurora, Texas is famous because in 1879, supposedly, a steam airship crashed into a judge's windmill, and the occupant was found dead, and they gave him a Christian burial in the cemetery that's in Aurora, Texas, and you can visit it. Yes, it's he's got a name. His name is Ned the Alien, and he's featured on the town's website, and if you drive into town on the main road, one of the first things you see is a big Aurora sign with a crashed saucer and a windmill next to it. Hey, folks, I don't make the news, I just report it. That's what happened in Aurora, Texas, and you can visit the quote-unquote grave of Ned in the cemetery. However, it is unmarked. They had a marked grave, and it kept getting stolen, so they removed that marker. But there is a very interesting rock that kind of is what people think of as the grave of Ned, and you will find it if you go in the entrance to the right and turn right at the quote-unquote interesting tree, you will find it pretty handily. Aurora, Minnesota. My visit there was all about mining. Everything was mining, mining, mining. And that town is so associated with mining that in the middle of town, there is this big lake, and it used to be a mine. It was an open-pit iron mine, and iron ore is one of these things where you need large quantities to make it economical, and they dug this massive hole in the ground, and it filled up with water, and the town was like, hey, thanks for the lake, and they used that lake for recreation and even drinking water, and it's this big lake, and it kind of gives the town a sense of serenity that was not there when they were digging it out. So that's called the St. James Mining Pit, St. James Lake now. And it's interesting to go out there and just see this nice little bit of nature and learn that it's the result of open pit mining with no thought for the environment whatsoever. Aurora, Iowa has the Richardson Jockwell House, which is the first house of European settlement in that part of Iowa, Buchanan County. And this is the kind of thing that people would make a movie about. This guy moved out there by himself and built a house basically nowhere. This was 1850. I mean, you know, if you've seen Dances with Wolves, it's kind of like that, except instead of Fort Sedgwick, this guy built his house. And it was woodsy at the time, so it wasn't quite the prairie, but he built the house, and then a couple traveling west stopped by, and he convinced them to build a cabin there, and it became a town. And now it is a forest reserve with camping and trails, and it's a nice little part of the Smokestacks and Silos region. It's not flashy, it's not big, it just kind of gives you a chance to get in the moment of what things were like in the middle of the 19th century when the country was expanding so quickly. But if you built a house in this part of Iowa, you would be living utterly alone, if you ignore the native population, who was obviously there. South Dakota. South Dakota and Iowa, the towns themselves actually look quite similar, but South Dakota, well, when I was there, they were selling t-shirts for a thing called Pickle Day. And I was like, oh, what's Pickle Day? And they were like, well, we don't know. And I was like, what do you mean you don't know? And what's the town's association with pickles? And thinking, we don't have one. So nobody knows why they had a Pickle Day. I have a shirt. It's a bright green shirt that says Aurora, South Dakota Pickle Days on it. Nobody knows why. somebody decided they needed a pickle day, and indeed they had one, but it's gone now. Too many people were like, what the heck does pickles have to do with Aurora, South Dakota? So now it's called Gala Day, and this, or Gala Days, and this still goes on. But one of the cool things is that they have a citywide rummage sale. Now, this is not a big town, but basically that's the day for everybody to get the stuff out of their basement and put it out for sale. And the whole town comes out and just goes around town and visits everybody else's stuff they don't want. I think it sounds like a really fun day, and what a great community activity. So if that sounds good, South Dakota is the place. West Virginia, Aurora, West Virginia, has Cathedral State Park. And it's called that because as you walk through the trees, they're so tall that it's like walking into a cathedral. And it's the last stand of old growth hemlock forest in the entire state of West Virginia. I mean, there's probably pockets here and there, but this is the last large area of contiguous old growth hemlock forest, with some of the trees in there being 500 years old. It's a stunningly beautiful place to see, as is much of West Virginia. Boy, I had a hard time writing that chapter, I have to tell you. Aurora, Maine was next. Now, Aurora, Maine is on what's called the Airline, and this is a road that's been named that was named that long before airplanes. It has nothing to do with airplanes. It has to do with this road they made where there were disconnected towns, and they were separated by really harsh wilderness and hills, and some entrepreneurs got together and said, we're just going to go straight. And they made this road go over hill and dale, through marshes and bogs and over mountains. And it goes way up high. And it connected the northeastern part of Maine with more central communities. And it's called the Airline because it was up way up high in the air. And there's all kinds of legends about the airline, about how it was so dangerous to travel and there were highwaymen out there and all this stuff. A lot of it probably fiction. But one thing we do know that was fiction was that Stephen King traveled this road, because Bangor is at one side of it. And if you've ever read the short story Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, yeah, that is based on the region around the airline, with the airline being in the middle. And as you're driving this road, you can imagine the descriptions of Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, and that's where you're driving. Just, I would recommend you do not try to find a shortcut. Stay on the airline. That would be the wise move. Now, this one's a little complicated. New York. There are two Auroras in New York. The naming is endlessly confusing. I'm not going to try to explain them to you here. Just know that East Aurora is west of Aurora, but that East Aurora's actual real name is Aurora. All right, I already confused things. But the first Aurora I went to was Aurora on Cayuga, which is a lake in the Finger Lakes. This is an old historic town. If you've ever heard of Wells Fargo, this is the home of Wells College, where Wells Fargo came from. There's a bar there that has a bunch of history about it. But the main thing to see there is the restored downtown area, which was purchased by one person who you may not have heard of, but you have heard of what she did. That person was Pleasant Rowland, and she created the American Girls dolls. Which, you know, if you've seen these dolls, they like take a period in history and then imagine, you know, what would an 8-year-old girl look like in that period? What accessories would she have? And then sell them for really handsome prices. And well, she bought a whole town and did that. So she's taken a bunch of the historic buildings, renovated them, and they're kind of like Airbnbs, except it's not Airbnb, it's her. And you can rent out for a weekend some of these historic houses along the main drag. It is a beautiful, beautiful place to visit, and I definitely recommend you go there. There's a lot. It was hard to pick something there. There's a lot going on in this little town of Aurora on Cayuga. Now, East Aurora in New York, which is west, I'll forget it. Just know there's two of them. There's a lot to see there, too. It's the headquarters of Play School. It is also the headquarters of the Roycroft movement, which is an arts and crafts style of design and architecture. But the actual thing that I think most people would be interested in if you're spending just a little bit of time, is Vidler's Five and Dime, the country's largest Five and Dime store. And you just go in there, and it's enormous, and they've got all the traditional Five and Dime stuff you might imagine. You know, Five and Dime stores, if you're not familiar with that term, they were low-price general stores, but a little bit bigger than the general stores that had come before them. In fact, they turned into things like Kresge's, which became Kmart, which is now known as Spirit Halloween in many places. But before that, if you grew up in the 70s, Kmart was a major part of your life, probably, and that was an offshoot of the Five and Dime. And this Vidler's is a callback to when Five and Dimes, such, you know, like Woolworth's was a Five and Dime, for example, was a mainstay of every community, and they've got lots of fun little gadgets and things there. Great place to stop. Then, Aurora, Ohio. Aurora, Ohio used to have a lot of stuff there. It had one of the country's oldest and favorite amusement parks called, and I always pronounce this wrong, Geauga, which was on Geauga Lake. That's Geauga. Classic old trolley park that people loved, but it closed in 2007. And also they had, and this is still hard for me to believe, SeaWorld. They had a SeaWorld in Ohio, which became Six Flags Worlds of Adventure, which then collapsed. All that's gone now. They don't have any of that anymore. But what they do have is a kind of cool little niche, pick your pronunciation there, thing called the Flying Aces of Aurora. And it's an airport, but it's a special airport because it's strictly for model planes. And there are air parks like this in many parts of the country, but this one is really done up with a paved tarmac runway for people to land their really elaborate planes on. They have a no jets policy. Yes, folks, there are model jet aircraft. For noise reasons, they can't have that. But they have everything else. And if you were really into model aircraft, you probably have heard of this place because YouTube is filled with videos of all these really elaborate model planes taking off and landing there. So, kind of a cool thing. Nebraska, Aurora, Nebraska. I will say this until I'm blue in the face. The best free campground in the United States is Streeter Park in Aurora, Nebraska. It's not far from the I-80 exit. I stop there every single time I'm crossing country on I-80. I don't know why everybody doesn't, and I'm amazed that I always find a place there. Free electricity, free water, free dump station, picnic tables, flush toilets, free. You can stay for 4 days. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about Susan's Bookshop. I've mentioned this before. The story regarding my trip to Aurora, Nebraska, and Susan is long, but it's fascinating. But I have to not include it here. But her bookshop I do have to include here. She told me that anyone who listens to my podcast who wants to go into town and get a free book can just go to her shop and say, hey, I heard about your shop on the podcast. I'd like a free book. Go ahead and do it. She's got this massive collection of new and used books, and she will basically let anybody have a used book who comes in the store. She has a huge kids section. We have a need in the world for more people like Susan and more bookstores like Susan's. And if you are ever driving through on I-80, all you have to do is I-80 in Nebraska. I hear all the time, oh, Nebraska is so boring. Okay, fine. Stop in Aurora, Nebraska. Break up your trip and see what this town is like. There's big museums there. There's a flashing light in the courthouse. There's a whole story behind that. There's a lot going on in this little town. But it all starts at Susan's Bookshop. So make sure you go there. Colorado. Aurora, Colorado. Easily the largest Aurora. Sadly, the reason you have probably heard of Aurora, Colorado is because some guy dressed up as the Joker from Batman and shot up a movie theater. That's what put Aurora on the public's map. Before that, it was just thought of as, oh, a suburb of Denver. Actually, it's bigger than Denver, and it's growing. And Denver, because of geography, can't grow anywhere. And it's getting to be a problem. Aurora is kind of swallowing up Denver. And it may be that the two towns merge or something. Who knows what's going to happen? But a lot of folks now, when they say they're from Denver, are actually from Aurora. One thing to see, there's a lot of things to see in Aurora. Having to pick something is difficult. But the thing I chose to pick is called the 720 Memorial. That was the date of this tragic event at the movie theater. What do you do when something like that happens? You build a memorial to it and move on. And that's what the town did. And the memorial is very peaceful. It's a really thoughtful place to walk through. And I won't tell you about it, but if you're ever in Aurora, Colorado, you do need to go visit the 720 Memorial. It'll take you 10 minutes, half an hour if you're a more thoughtful person. It's free, of course. It's outdoors, but it's moving. And that's the point. Aurora, Utah. Now, this is a place that very few people go to. This is a Mormon town in the center of Utah, and it is a baffling place to me. I've been there twice, haven't seen a person either time. I know they're there. It's this very neat community with lots of well-taken care of homes, with many with horses. Up in the hills beyond it, instead of a football field, they have a rodeo pen. And behind that, I found all kinds of bullet casings. I think they were using it as kind of a firing range up there, a shooting range. One weird thing about this town is that it's legal to ride ATVs on the street. It's part of an ATV trail system. But the thing to see there, if you're not an LDS person and the culture is something unusual for you, you can learn something about it just by going to the cemetery. I'm always talking about cemeteries because if you can't find anything interesting in a place, you can always go to the cemetery because all cemeteries are interesting. This one's especially interesting, especially if you've seen other cemeteries. It's an LDS cemetery. It's on a hill. It's very neatly manicured. Lots and lots and lots of rows of headstones, but they're different. There are no crosses except one. I found one cross on one headstone in the entire, I don't know how many hundreds of people are buried there, but there's a lot. And they have words on them that might not be familiar to you. They have a birth date and a death date, but they also have a sealed date. What is sealed? What does that mean? Well, in the LDS religion, sealed means married, because marriage isn't for life in the LDS church. It's forever. It's you're sealed to another person, and your two souls or spirits or whatever you want to call it are joined together for life. And after death, you're still joined together. So it's a sealing. And that date is often put on the tombstones. A lot of them have pictures, but it's just interesting. And it was also interesting how just driving around this town, I was a complete alien. It was like I landed on another planet. It felt like one of the Martian Chronicle books by Ray Bradbury, where there's somebody in a town and there's nobody else there. I don't know. I still haven't wrapped my head around this place. But if you're ever in that section of Utah, and you're not familiar with, you know, what real Utah is like, not Salt Lake City, but like the rest of the state, you can learn stuff in Aurora. Aurora, Nevada, ghost town, was 10,000 people, now is zero. The only thing left is a cemetery and a big wall. The cemetery is really interesting, but the one interesting thing in the cemetery to check out is the grave of a gunslinger. There is a gunslinger's grave that somebody tried to steal, and apparently it was too heavy. They dropped it, and it broke. So it's actually farther away from the cemetery. That's the legend. Another part of that story might be that they didn't want him buried with everybody else. He was basically a loudmouth, and he was causing trouble and always bothering people. And one night he came out of a bar drunk, and somebody shot him in the back of the head. Fix that problem. He needed killing. You know, this was the literal Old West. And you can visit his grave. It's a little bit difficult to find. If you want to find the gunslinger's grave and you can't get enough instruction online, get in touch with me and I have directions. I actually have a video that shows the walk there, I think. Anyway, Aurora, Nevada is one of the more difficult places that you are going to try to go to. It is all off-road, but it is fascinating to stand in the place where Mark Twain used to live and mine and actually sold his first writing. Kansas, Aurora, Kansas, which the locals call that Catholic town. Very, very small town. I think of all these places, with the exception of the ghost town of Nevada, it has the fewest people, like 56. But they have a standalone jail there. It's this stone building with a little chimney sticking out of the roof that's just kind of off. Well, there's not much. There's only like six blocks in this town, but it's off on the side behind the train station, which is no longer functioning. And it's been there since the 1800s. And it actually had someone famous in it. The guy who shot John Wilkes Booth was one of the first white residents of Aurora. He lived in the hole in the ground because there weren't any trees, so that's how people lived there. Again, Dances with Wolves, if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. He kind of got a little crazy, and they had to lock him up in that jail before they committed him to an insane asylum. And that is there in the little town of Aurora, Kansas. Aurora, Kansas is also really interesting because it's surrounded by giant windmills, and you can drive right up to them. So if you've ever wondered how big those windmills really are, you can find out near Aurora, Kansas. Aurora, Kentucky. This is in the part called the Land Between the Lakes. There's a really big, weird, square lake there. And Aurora, Kentucky isn't like a city. It's an area almost, but it had... There's stuff to see there. Again, I'm having trouble picking the one thing, but the thing that fascinated me the most was Cherokee State Park. This was a state park placed by the state in this nice area of Kentucky strictly for black people. During the era of separate but equal, they tried to prove that that could be done by having a place just for black people and a place just for white people. So depending on what side of the lake you were on, you were either surrounded by black people or surrounded by white people. The Civil Rights Act actually ended this practice, which ended the park once it was quote-unquote integrated. Well, it's complex, but it was no longer the special place for black folks that it once was. People used to travel from all over to go to this place. Now it had the same problems as society in general, and folks stopped coming. But it's still there. You can see it. You can see the old buildings, and they're still, you know, they're in good shape. But interesting little weird segment of history that you don't really hear about in history books. Aurora, Ontario. Honestly, the thing about Aurora, Ontario that was so interesting to me is just how normal it was. It was just a normal place, a normal section of Canadian life. And the thing to see there is the Arboretum, because if you're not familiar with how things grow in Canada, they have a very short growing season, but the days are really long. So some of the stuff they can grow, especially flowers, are incredibly impressive. And the Aurora Arboretum is one of those places. I mean, it's just stunning. You're thinking, oh, I'm up here in the frozen north. Yeah, not in August. Not in August. In August and September, you can see just amazing growth. In fact, if you've ever toured through Canada, one of the things almost every place has is a garden to visit, and Aurora is no exception. So I would head there if you're ever in the area. This is not too far from Toronto. I mean, this is not the boonies by any means. Aurora, Oregon. Oh, fascinating history. Aurora, Oregon was a utopian community. Long, long story there. But the thing to visit is the Aurora Mills Architectural Salvage Company. It's this big complex where they actually take architectural salvage seriously. If they find out an old building is being torn down, they'll go in and save what they can and sell it to the public. And this isn't just for tourists. This is a major business, although tourists are more than welcome. And there's a few of these places in Chicago, one called Salvage One. I mean, I really like these places, but this one is enormous, and it's fun just to walk around in there because, yeah, they sell doors and arches and fireplaces and things like that, but they also sell, like, doorknobs and just, like, there were a whole set of mismatched billiard balls. It's just whatever they found that could be of value, they have on display and you can buy it. Super nice folks, really interesting place to visit, even if you just treat it like a museum. But you can actually go there and get a souvenir to take back with you that you can carry on the plane, unlike a door. Aurora, North Carolina. This is in the Inner Bank of North Carolina. You hear a lot about the Outer Banks. This is in the Inner Bank. This is a very small town, a little bit hard to get to. It's nowhere near the interstate, but it's right next to the world's largest phosphate mine, and they find all kinds of fossils in there. So there's a fossil museum right downtown, and that shows a lot of the fossils that they find in this marine layer. So a lot of shark teeth and things like that. But they do this really cool thing that in the lot across the street, they will have tailings brought in from the mine and just dumped there. And then they invite kids and anyone else to just sort through and see what they find. And people are finding all kinds of shark's teeth and fossilized clams and things like that, just like digging around in this parking lot. That's free. The museum costs money, and the museum needs help. It's so out of the way that they're constantly struggling for funds, so if you can go there and give them some love, I would personally appreciate it. But the digging in the parking lot, that is free. Aurora, Illinois. Second biggest Aurora, a lot going there. It's been in the news lately for sadly not good reasons. And there's a whole lot to see here. But the one thing of all the things to see in Aurora, Illinois that I'm recommending is the History Museum. A lot of these Auroras have history museums. They're the kinds of places that are open like Sunday from 2 to 4 or something like that. And you just have to get lucky to get in there. Not in Aurora, Illinois. They have a really, really well done museum. And it tells the history of Aurora, Illinois, how it was the first city in the United States to have electric lights, how it used to be a stop for travelers going through the area. And they had this, well, anyway, I have to stop. But check out the History Museum in Aurora, Illinois. It is really special. And then finally, Aurora, Indiana. That's the order I went in. I know it doesn't make sense, but it made sense at the time. Aurora, Indiana, which is right on the Ohio River across from Kentucky, has several really interesting things to see. But the most famous thing, I think, is the cemetery. Again, it's the Riverview Cemetery. It's down right next to a creek that leads right into the river. And a woman named Audley Aurora, that was her name, used to drive around town in this convertible Cadillac. And when she died in the 80s, she asked her husband, can I be buried in the Cadillac? And he made the arrangements and bought 13 or 14 plots and buried her in her Cadillac. They dug this huge hole, made a concrete vault around it, lowered the Cadillac into it, and then placed her coffin on the trunk and back seats, because, of course, it's a convertible. The top was down. And she's still there. But I'll tell you what. You know what you see when you go to see a woman buried in a Cadillac in a cemetery? Grass. She's buried. You're not going to see anything. But you can go visit the site and say you've been there. And then after that, go see the actual really interesting things like the Indian Mound, which you can figure out the story is that this is where the native people buried their dead. So this is where the European settlers also buried their dead. Like, you know, oh, that's where the dead people go. All right, well, we'll put them over there. And one of those dead people in there is a Captain Pattinson from Gettysburg, Union officer hiding behind a rock during the battle on Culp's Hill, survives the battle, arranges to have the rock moved to Aurora, and it was going to serve as his tombstone. And when they did bury him there, they put him near that rock, but they actually gave him a little tombstone that has his name on it and everything. But if you look at the rock, you can see three musket holes, they're calling them, or bullet holes, right in the middle of the rock. I wonder how true that story is. The bullet holes look awfully symmetrical, and they're all the same size and shape. I don't know, but that's the story, and that is in Aurora, Indiana. And holy cow, I can talk about Auroras forever, and I feel like I've talked about them too much. But I had to do that, and I hope you found that kind of fun, and I hope it proved my point that there's interesting stuff everywhere, even if you draw a name out of a hat and just go to a place. If you have the right mindset, you will find interesting stuff. Thank you this month to Jen, who was very generous and bought me some gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And no, it was not my wife, Jen. She is always very, very generous to me. It was somebody else. So thank you, Jen, and thank you to everyone who donates every month. If you would like to support this podcast and keep ads far, far away, visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, and you can buy me a gallon or two of whatever you'd like. Special thanks to those of you who do this every single month. You are amazing. Tech Talk. Okay, you may have heard of thermal bridging. Insulation's a tough topic. People get into such fights over it, and I've said for a while now that it's just not that important. It's important, but when you look at the big picture, trying to perfectly insulate a van is a way to madness, and I just think you should just do what makes sense and don't worry about it. In the winter, it's really easy to heat your van, so not having enough insulation just doesn't matter all that much. And in the summer, well, less insulation can be better because the insulation holds heat in and it can take longer to cool off the inside of the van. Just even saying that is controversial. But you will come across this term called thermal bridging. All that means is different materials conduct heat better. And basically they're talking about metal. So the metal of your van will conduct heat maybe 1,000 times faster than a piece of foam. And what can happen is that if you insulate in between the ribs of the roof of your van and leave the metal exposed, the cold will find its way to those ribs, thermal bridging, and make everything in the van cold. And that's true. That can happen. That is a thermal bridging thing. If you ever investigate replacing the windows in your house, you can see this term come up too, because they will separate metal from touching metal with some kind of a sealant or rubber or something like that. That stops the heat from going from one piece of metal, the one on the outside, to the pieces of metal on the inside. Vehicles are not built this way. Vehicles figure you can overcome the cold or heat with the air conditioning or the heat from the engine. But we're not really living like that. Here's a way to think about this, though. When you're doing insulation in your van, you don't have to really get your mind around thermal bridging or whatever that. Just think about heat as being like electricity. And if you don't want electricity to go from one wire to another one, you have to prevent them from touching. Insulation of wires is the same as insulation from thermal bridging. It's the same concept. One is heat, one is electricity. Well, you know, technically those are the same thing. All right, yeah, okay, Mr. Physics guy, we're not going to go there. But that's it. Don't worry about the term thermal bridging. Just know that it means you want to insulate between pieces of metal. If you have a piece of metal on the outside of the van, make sure that that does not connect to metal on the inside of the van. Except, don't worry too much about it, because it just doesn't matter. Product review. So I picked up a couple of solar wireless backup cameras from a company called AutoVox. Now be careful here. AutoVox is not AudioVox. They're two different companies. AudioVox has been around a while, and while they didn't have the greatest reputation anyway, AutoVox is one of these Chinese companies that just made up a name. Okay, we get it. Fine. The idea with this system is that it's simple. It comes with a monitor that you put on your dashboard, and it's about the size of a rearview mirror, actually. It's that same format. Comes with nice pad that you stick to your dashboard, and then you plug that into a cigarette lighter or another 12-volt source. And then the cameras mount to your front license plate bracket, would be a good place, and then the back one is magnetic, and you can stick it on whatever you want. Like a trailer, or if your trailer's fiberglass or aluminum, it comes with plates you can mount, and then you stick it on those. Once you plug it in, it just works. There's no wiring, and it has different modes. Like, you can watch both cameras, you can watch just the front camera, or just the back camera, or no cameras. All of that works. I tried it. It works great, and you would think I would give this thing a glowing review. And if that's all you want, if you're looking for something that's just temporary like that, this thing is great. Oh, also, it does record in a loop, so it can act like a dash cam, too. You just have to explicitly tell it, hey, save that bit, because I think it's a half-hour loop. You need to buy an SD card to stick in there to do that. Here's the negative part of this review. The solar recharging of the batteries isn't enough to keep up with the power they draw. So if you want the camera to be on all the time, like let's say that you want the rear camera to be on all the time and act as your rearview mirror because you're towing a trailer, or in my case, you have this massive fiberglass cap thing that's blocking your rearview mirror, it will drain the battery in the camera and eventually it will shut off. What's the solution for this? Well, each camera has a battery in it and you're supposed to recharge it USB, but I mean, that's not necessarily convenient. So what I think I'm going to have to do is actually run a 5-volt circuit to the camera that I have mounted on the back of the pod just to keep it alive. And then the front camera, which I have mounted on my front license plate, I'm only going to turn that on when I'm parking. It's distracting to watch it while you're moving anyway, so that's just going to be when I'm parking, when I'm trying to inch up on somebody in the city, which is something I do a lot, so that will be very useful. There are no outputs on this thing. You can't connect it to any other monitors. You can't connect it to the built-in thing. That's it. Everything I've described, that's what you get, and that's it. It's about $200. The picture is very good. It connects easily. I haven't had any problems like that. It does night vision and daylight stuff. Everything is great. My complaint is that you kind of have to run power wires to it if you're going to use it for my application, which is to get it to replace the rearview mirror. So do I recommend it? Yeah, it depends. If you're somebody who tows a trailer once in a while and you just want a backup camera for the back of the trailer, absolutely. This is probably going to work great. Charge it up before you go and you're going to be fine. But if you're going to use it like I am every day, well, then you got to wire stuff in. And at that point, maybe you should just get wired cameras. You have to make that decision for yourself. Anyway, link in the show notes. It is the Autovox 2 quantity solar wireless backup camera system. Pretty good. I just wish there was a way to make it a little better. Tales from the road. Well, since we're talking about auroras, I have to give you a quick tale about one visit in Aurora. This was in Aurora, Maine. So I was on the airline, which I described earlier. And at the top of the airline, just outside of Aurora, or right on the edge of Aurora, there was a place called Mace's or Macy's. No one really was sure how to pronounce it. It was spelled capital M-A-C, capital E-S, Macy's. I looked up who owned it. That wasn't their name. I don't know. But it was an ice cream stand and drive-in. And sadly, I'm saying was, because it has gone out of business since I was there. COVID killed it and a death in the family. Long story there that my research revealed. But I, on this day, had driven a long way. I'd come up from Rhode Island, traveled to Stephen King's house and stuff, and went to Aurora, Maine, saw all the blueberry fields and the old schoolhouse and what's called Whale's Back, a beautiful overlook of the Maine wilderness. And I thought, hey, an ice cream sounded good. So I pulled into this Macy's and went up, and it was a classic, you know, slide the window open, what would you like? There's ice cream menu and everything, and they sold all kinds of food. And I asked for a creamy, and they didn't know what I was talking about, because in Vermont, soft serve is called creamies, but in Maine, we just call it soft serve. So, and I started talking to these two girls, and they were dressed in Hawaiian shirts. I believe they had just graduated from high school, from the context of everything that we talked about, and I'm calling them girls, and it's because they were very young, except they're technically young women. I apologize if I've offended anybody with my language about how I'm referring to them. But that was the impression I got. These were young people. And I was the only person there, and they're making the ice cream, and I'm asking, you know, questions about what do you do in Aurora, what's good to see around here. And our conversation turned to something very interesting. The two girls, one blonde and one dark hair, had very different outlooks on life and their futures. The girl with dark hair was going to college in New Jersey and was very excited. And though she would miss Aurora, she was thrilled to be going to see the big world. She had visited New York City once and had a great time and couldn't wait to go and see what it was like to live near there. And the other girl was exactly the opposite. She was like, hey, you know, this is my home, all my folks are here, and she had relatives that ran a general store in town, so there were like deep roots there, and she couldn't imagine ever being somewhere not there because Aurora was home. And it really got me thinking about how there's two kinds of people. I mean, I don't know how many two kinds of people there are. You hear that expression all the time. But there's definitely a division between people who are willing to leave to look for opportunity or just curiosity, and people who could never even fathom doing that because this is home. This is where I belong. What do you mean that I could go somewhere else? Then I wouldn't be home. That doesn't make any sense. And these two young women embodied that. And it was just an interesting moment that as I travel through all these auroras, so many of them were created by people like the dark-haired young lady who was going to New Jersey. They were people looking for opportunities and willing to set down roots somewhere else. While the blonde young woman was the one who was what the auroras become. All these little auroras that have just a few people living in them, that's who's living there. People like that. People who are descended from people like that. People who think, this is home. I can't go anywhere else, regardless of what opportunities come and go. It's just a really interesting moment. And I took a picture of them, which is not something I ever do. I don't take pictures of people as a rule. It's a weird thing. I don't like taking pictures of people because when I look at them later, it bothers me because there they are then, usually smiling, and I know what happens after. And reconciling those two things, I don't know, it bugs me. But I did take a picture of them, which is really weird, but I'm glad I have it. because I will never find out what happened to them. But I have that one moment in time preserved where they had each made a choice. And in that moment, they were both young women of Aurora, working at one of the only businesses in Aurora, representing Aurora. But a year later, they wouldn't be, or only one of them would be. A place to visit. So, Chicago has been in the news a lot lately, too. Not for necessarily good things. But there was a particularly embarrassing moment where somebody famous referred to, I believe the words were, Chicago's Miracle Mile Shopping Center. We don't have that. Chicago does not have a Miracle Mile, nor do we have a Miracle Mile Shopping Center. What we have is the Magnificent Mile, a high-end shopping district on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago that is very, very popular with tourists. A lot of people come to Chicago just to walk down that street. And it's very nice. It's really well kept up. And there's super high-end stores there. But there's a secret. There's a thing that very few people know and stop at. They will stop at the outside and take pictures, but very few of them know that you can go inside. And that is the water pump complex. So there's a water tower that's famous for surviving the Chicago fire. And it looks like a castle. It's this tan gray stone building that rises up about five stories. It's really hard to miss. It's right on Michigan Avenue. And at one time, after the fire, that was the only thing standing on that part of Michigan Avenue. Across the street, even, is there's another building that looks like it's the same architecture, but it looks much more purpose-built. It's square. Same ornamentation, but, you know, you're like, well, no, they're getting serious with this building. Well, you can go in that building, and you can see water pumps. There are four old water pumps in there, and they have weird names. And I'm not going to tell you what the names are, but they're named not after places in Chicago, but people in Chicago. Each one of those names refers to somebody who worked in the water complex there. And those massive pumps originally pumped water out of the lake. And if you look on the lake, you will see what looks like they could be ships or they could be like little castles or islands out in the lake. Those are called cribs. And that's where the water came from that was pumped by these massive pumps and fed the city. Well, the pumps are still in use. They're still using them to pump water from Chicago, but they no longer get the water from the lake. It actually comes from someplace else now. That said, you can just walk in and see these pipes. And it's just very quick thing. This isn't going to be an all-day activity or anything. You just walk in and see these massive old pumps, not super old, like 1930s old. You know, they were updated. But it's kind of a cool place to go and feel like, ooh, I'm in a secret place. And there's a good restaurant in that same building, and then there's a theater in there also that does really innovative theater. So if you plan your cards right, you actually could spend all day there, or at least a good afternoon and evening. I'll have a link in the show notes if you're trying to find this, but it's not hard to find. It's just that nobody ever goes there. And some of the people who do are disappointed because they're like, oh, it's just a building with old pumps in it. No, no, it's a building with old pumps in it. It's actually very exciting. I like it, and I actually kind of like the kind of secret nature of it. Resource recommendation. One of the hardest things to do in the winter is find water. And I ran into this when I drove the Tiki Bago from Oregon to Illinois in March. I couldn't find any place to get fresh water. Everything was shut down for the winter. So here is a resource that will work for you in some cases. This isn't going to solve all your problems, but it might help. And it's called findaspring.org. And as you might have guessed, it is a crowdsourced map of springs all across the United States. And that's their thing. It's got to be a spring. Not free water. That's not the thing. It's got to be a spring. So this is free and paid and sometimes private springs all across the U.S., some of which you can literally just pull up next to and get water and pour it in your rig. There was one in Sandwich, Massachusetts that I saw that local residents were filling up to bring into their homes. I ran into one in Montana that I didn't stop at, but boy, I wish I had. I mean, they're all over. There's a lot of them in the Northeast, actually, where it's easy to actually get water to put in your rigs. You need like a jerry can or something. You're not going to hook a hose up to it. I suppose if you had like a water bandit, that might work, but you need a long hose. And it's good, clean water. Now, I'm not vouching for the safety or taste of this water. Any water you get like this, you're responsible for filtering it or testing it or whatever. But it's out there, and this is a resource for finding it. They also include hot springs, which may be more suitable for dipping into than drinking. I will let you decide. At any rate, it's findaspring.org. Link in the show notes. Well, folks, thank you for listening to this rather lopsided episode 279. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And until next time, remember the words of Ernest Hemingway, who said, "It is good to have an end to journey toward, but it is the journey that matters in the end."